Good evening. This is Discourse. Tonight, the fifth in a series of lectures given during January at St. Olaf College on the topic Native American Values and the Dominant American Culture. Our speaker tonight is Artley Skenendor Jr., an Oneida who is co-director of Soaring Eagle Survival School. The title of his talk is Native American Survival Schools. We must apologize for the rather poor audio quality of this recorded address, but we hope that you will find the program interesting in spite of this situation. Here is Artley Skenendor.
Our school is called the Soaring Eagle Survival School. And what is survival? You know, we have college students here. Survival, economically, politically, socially, religiously. What is important to you as an individual is what makes it, I guess, a college education, what makes it a high school education, what makes the significance of going to school, period. Now, I work as a counselor in a public school system also, and I guess that's how come the Soaring Eagle Survival School got started, because I saw too many people that didn't know how to survive. I saw people that didn't know how to add and subtract, didn't know how to read, you know, and they're going out into the world, and I was really concerned about them, and in fear of what might happen, you know, and if they were to come to a place like this, they wouldn't survive, they wouldn't get to first base. I got lucky, I made it to second base, and then I falled out. And so I'm back home now, polishing my baseball bat. I'm gonna go back at it maybe next year. I don't know. At the present time, I am the director of the Soaring Eagle Survival School. I'd like to tell you a story about how it got its name, but first I'd like to tell you a story about why it was formed. It started back in June when I left here, finished finals, walked home like a zombie, drained after an all-nighter, didn't know where I was, and all of a sudden I woke up, and I was sitting down on Rhinestone Cowboy Country, Broadway Street in Green Bay, and there it was, you know, and I said, how'd I get here? What happened was I took a job as a counselor for a youth program, and I started meeting some of these kids that I haven't seen in a really long time, because I hadn't been back, you know, and hadn't spent enough time where I should have been, I guess. And so I met these kids, 15, 14, things like this. And we were trying to do some basic things, you know, and learn some things about nature and spiritualism, things that are important to a traditional person. And what came out of that was I found that a lot of these young people didn't know what the word Indian meant. They didn't know what spiritualism meant. And I says, well, what do you do in school? Fool around, getting a lot of fights. Why do you get in a lot of fights? Because people call me names, call me, you know, Indian, skin, you know, things like that. Put me down. And I says, well, you should know how to combat that without having to fight. I said, no, that's all I know how to do. And it's really true. There's a thing called, for the academic people, it's called pride fixation, where you don't know enough about yourself, you're insecure. So, but at the same time, you don't want somebody putting you down, you know, but you have that pride within you. It's inculcated, and it stays there forever. But you have to know how to work with that. You don't have to know how to put that to your use. And so, these people said, well, I don't know any more than just being Indian. You know, that's all there is for me. And they said, well, what about, you know, public schools? What do they do for you? Do you have Oneida language? Do you have Menominee language, Menominee culture, Oneida culture, things like this in the school system? No, don't have anything like that. I don't know anything about it. You know, and they're asking questions. Well, where do I find this? How do I find it? And I'm learning myself, you know. My appearance has changed in the last 2 years to many of you. When I first came, I had cut my hair because I thought, well, try that for a while and see how I like that. And I found it didn't work out, so it's growing back again. And I feel a rebirth in coming back here and talking to all you people. because the topic that I'd like to reach to you in terms of survival is through a spiritual message. A spiritual message that comes from my experience in public education and my experience with survival school education. And I see a lot of people here, maybe of you. How many are education majors? Good. Glad to see you're here. So it's your responsibility to learn people how to survive. It's your responsibility for people to understand one another and to be sensitive and aware. I just got done speaking to, I believe it's a literature class, Native American literature class over dinner. And we spoke about that thing called awareness and sensitivity. Because to me, it's all interlocked together, you know. Sensitivity, awareness, survival. You have to have all of them and have to have them in your hand wherever you go. Because you have to know how to put them to your use, you know. To be spiritual is to be aware and to be sensitive. And the first thing you learn is how to survive, you know. Dr. Bo is here, and he spoke to you before, I believe, and he probably spoke a little bit about that idea of old Indians. You know, the reason why they're so together is because they know how to survive. They know how to survive spiritually. They know how to survive within an offense of two worlds, so to speak. Here we go. I'd like to use this. First time I ever get to write on a same old chalkboard. You know, I used to sleep and let everybody else write on these before. But this part over here is what most of you people know about from Chris's time on. You know about this period, because this is what you know as being Indian. And this is what goes into the public schools. But for our Soaring Eagle Survival School, we have our resource consultants, we have our teachers. All our teachers are around 60 to 80 years old. Pardon? Right on. Because I don't know anything. I'm teaching urban survival. I'm teaching people not to rip off. I'm teaching people how not to get ripped off by the system. But our teachers, you know, spiritual teachers. They teach you the spiritual side of survival. And they teach about this side over here. And according to the so-called experts, this part over here is dead. You know, it's long time ago, 1492. You know, that's a long time, nothing happened. You know, but we know that our spiritual people call it, that this is where the truth lies to understanding this whole thing over here, up until tonight, right here, 76. Happy birthday. That this over here is the part that you have to look for, that you have to seek. Pat Bellinger, I believe, spoke about families. This is where the family structure started. This is where the discipline of an Indian person started, where it was a discipline of a religion, you know, that being Indian is a religion. It's not something you do on Sundays, but it's all the time. And you probably heard people say that already. I find it really hard to sit up here and speak, because I remember everybody else that I brought down here to speak to you. And all of a sudden, here I am, I'm speaking to you, telling the same thing. You know, well, when do we stop? Maybe my son will do it next. But this is the thing that goes on. This is your linear philosophy. Straight line, you go down here to 76. And I'll get to that a little later on. I have a message for you about that also. But I'm getting off the track. I'm kind of messing around, flowing in different areas to see where I get the most interest. I'd like to tell you a few stories because I think they're important to understanding the word of survival and the survival school concept. You know, basically survival, you know, as the word quote unquote means teaching the core things of education. You have to learn how to, you know, talk, you have to learn how to walk, you have to learn how to add and subtract, you have to learn how to read. Those things are basic. And if you don't know how to do them, you know, see you around, Jack, because you just won't make it. You know, basically, you people here know how to survive. You've made it to college. But out on the street, there's another type of survival that you have to learn. And all those things put together, the Indian person you know, has a unique situation because he's just learning his culture. He's just now having the freedom to learn it openly. And he is trying to learn how to maintain his Indianness, his spiritual side of him, while he's coping, as he's sitting on that fence. As he delves in, he has to get a job to live. Whose streets do we walk down? You know, these type of things. He has to know how to do that. He has to know how to do it real well. But he has to know how to come home at night, you know, and know that his family structure is important. He has to know that he has to spend time with his kids, you know. And if he knows the Oneida language, he knows that he must speak it to his children, as we do in our house. Oneida was my first language. And I'm really glad to say that, you know, because I have a little nephew now. He's about 4.5, 5 months old. You know, only time I ever talk to him, I talk to him in Oneida. So that hopefully that he'll pick that up at a very young age. And he'll be able to carry that on. You know, so that's just a sidelight of what survival is. Now the Soaring Eagle Survival School is a school built on that concept. You know, native people, not all native people, but majority are native peoples, coming together, learning how to survive. They didn't know how to until now. There was a person, we had a case, he was a borderline catatonic, schizophrenic. He'd sit in a corner, facing the wall, for hours on end in a dark room, when we got him as a student. At the present right now, he's a second string boxer on the boxing team. He's the leader of the Red Council that we have within the school. He's been elected president last week. It happened all since October 6th, when he had a chance to relax. Because you have to relax in order to survive. When you're tense, you tend to sometimes take your alternative too quick, and you fall off short. He relaxed. He found out that there was a way to survive. He saw other people in the same situation that he was. And through intensive counseling, we were able to help him out. He's a success. We have a graduate from Soaring Eagle already also, working at the school again, going back as a volunteer. But that idea of survival schools is so threatening to many people. I'm one of the, I'm on the top 10 hit list of the John Birch Society right now in Wisconsin. They really love me, along with my cousins and family and everybody else involved. But that's no hither nor whither. But here we're to talk about survival schools. And when you talk about survival schools, I think you have to talk about public education also. My contention is, and I'll say it to you openly, using the contemporary word of exorcism, that the Indian person's, his spirit, has been exorcised by public education. That he's not able to see himself within that system, and so because of that fact, culturally, he tends to drop off, tends to slow down, doesn't always meet expectations. Value systems are different. You've heard some of that already, you know. I guess I don't want to go through all that, you know, the whole thing, because you should have heard that already. Over the last 2 years when we've had Indian people here talking about values, value conflicts, things like this, you know. So there has to be a built-in vehicle for a culture of all peoples within the system. I apologize if I sound pessimistic, because I'm really not. I believe that, you know, when we talk about sensitivity and awareness, you know, it comes from the self. You know, Eastern people know about this. You know, Western civilization is just learning. Eastern people have had it in their back pocket for a long time. You know, the individual, the self. Very important. We believe that that's a philosophical foundation of our school, too, that individual. You have to be sensitive enough to yourself to be aware of others. You can walk around and say, yeah, I'm aware of you, I'm aware of this, and things like that, you know. But to be really aware is to be sympathetic, to understand. I don't think we can use those words yet. As we throw around the word brotherhood, we have some learning to do, people, before we use the word brother. Because it's a big word. It means a whole lot of things put into one. It's spiritual to me to call a person brother. I don't throw that word around too often, unless I know what I'm talking about. Because there's things that you have to know to call a person brother. There's Iroquoian philosophy about things like that. It goes something like that: we are all alike in many ways, but very different. For because of the difference, we stem the root of a tree that we call a brother, because it is the bond that keeps us together. And if we don't be different, if we don't look to the fact that, yeah, we are the same, fine, but we have to be different in order to share things. I don't want you to be like me. I don't want to be like you. I like wearing ribbon shirts, turtle claws, and frog boots. So that's the way it is. You have to be different, but you have to be the same. But how can you do that? Is what we probably built in as a survival school concept. Now, I'd like to share you a story. It's a unified story, and it deals with the Soaring Eagle Survival School and how it got its name. It's an individual, it's a personal story of my own that I feel kind of explains to me, and hopefully it'll explain to you, because I have to talk to myself when I speak, because that way I understand, maybe I'll understand myself better. But the Soaring Eagle Survival School is a school of unity behind that spiritual thing. It's a spirit. You know, as long as we maintain our school as a spiritual school, we will maintain ourselves for year on end. But as soon as we become an academic setting and we start working for the achievement of credits rather than for the achievement of learning, you know, then we fall short. So we believe we're a spiritual school. We open every day with a prayer. And on the first day, the school had no name. But after offering tobacco, somehow I had the urge to tell this story. And I'll tell it to you because I believe it. It kind of tells to me of how we can be sensitive and aware of one another. It has to do with the eagle. And I was walking down a hall and I saw some stuffed birds in one of these rooms over here. And so that reminded me of the eagle, and I figured I better say this tonight because I like the story. It's really nice. And it came to me not too long ago, about 6 months ago. I was up on the Flat Rock Reservation in Montana with some old people. And we were looking at, I wanted to learn about eagles because they fly so nice, beautiful. You know, why is that? I was questioned when I was very young. Why does an eagle fly like that? So graceful. You know, he weighs so much, but he can fly so graceful. And I always wondered why Indian people, you know, native people, wear feathers, wear eagle feathers in their hair, a sign of power. Why is that? Why is it that they have to do that? Why is it that I do it myself? So I went seeking these questions, and I found some answers. And because of that, I believe it's an answer to the idea of sensitivity, and it's also it's an answer, or it's an analogy to awareness. For when an eagle flies, if he loses one feather, he becomes weak. You know, an Indian person, whenever he saw an eagle, was always soaring up above. Now, this is when the eagle is at its utmost beauty. It's when it's soaring and the power is emulating from it to all peoples and to everything around it. That's its significant place. Now, what is so significant about that? And an eagle can't soar as good when he has a feather missing. So I always thought that, well, an Indian person wears an eagle feather. That's important. But why is it? And then I started to remember those stories about that eagle. That the only time that he is together in beauty and unity and people are able to understand him and what he's good for is when he's soaring. He's soaring high above, a sign of unity. Because every feather has a job, has a responsibility to keep that eagle's beauty coming to the person or the beholder. So that awareness, you know, I'm aware of that eagle, and I'm sensitive to his need for each feather to do its job. And so I thought, well, you know, geez, I can apply that to human beings. You know, big light in my head. That we, each one of us, have a responsibility to ourselves to survive. But we have to be aware of one another if we are to do it in a unified fashion. Because one moves out beyond what he should, and everything's messed up. The CIA, the BIA, the FBI, they've kind of moved out from where they're supposed to be. They've kind of superseded the next feather. And so that's not really soaring the way it should. A lot of people, too, have not done their responsibility as a person to one another. You know? Not sensitive enough to yourself first. Not truthful with yourself. One of the biggest things that we try and get across to our students in the school is that idea of being sensitive to the next person next to you, being aware of his situation. Because we are bicultural. We're a bicultural school. We have Menominees, we have Oneidas, Ojibways, Lakotas, Stockbridges. You know, so we're bicultural. So we have to maintain some type of awareness and some sensitivity. So we look upon that eagle as holding that sensitivity bond that we have to have. But that soaring eagle school is very symbolic of many things that you can apply yourself, that you can look at as an individual. You know, an Indian person, they were always said to be crazy, you know, because they held so many things as being symbolic, you know, that when they saw something that they felt was spiritual, that they gave thanks for it right at that time, not later, you know, wait till Sunday, but right at that time, they would give thanks for what they saw, what their eyes were beholding. And we believe that's important, you know, it's kind of trying to slow things down a little bit. Everybody's speeding up, and we're kind of slowing down a little bit. You know, many of you remember Wounded Knee, and remember the elder people that supported the American Indian Movement. These people were supposedly radicals, you know, American Indian Movement. And here are these old spiritual leaders. They're not radicals, they're conservatives. They're conservatives in the utmost sense because they believe in conserving the Mother Earth and things around it, a land base. Very, you know, rednecks. Very conservative. Pardon the pun. But these people, you know, can learn so much from them. That's why our teachers are 60 and 80 years old. We don't want to be liberals. We don't want to be radicals. We want to be conservatives, you know, because that's where it's at. You know, the church out in Oneida just dispersed its claim on the Sacred Heart Seminary, something very similar to the Alexian Brothers Novitiate. And so it's sitting there right now, nothing happening to it. They kind of given up education and gone into oil or something, I guess. Not every feather doing their responsibility. That eagle isn't soaring. People aren't aware and sensitive with one another. That's why we have a survival school in Green Bay. That's why we're opening another one. That's why we're setting the plans for 4 more in Wisconsin within the next 2 years. People ask me about 10 times already, why are you coming back to St. Olaf next year? And I say, maybe, maybe not. Because I have my responsibility, you know, to that eagle also, as an individual. I have my responsibility to strengthen myself, you know. Sitting on that fence between two worlds, there's a certain dictation that says, I have to have a piece of paper. You know, I know I don't have all the answers, but I sympathize with people. And I think I can do something for them. That's why I stayed back in Green Bay. I was planning on coming back this year. I talked to Dean Roberts about August or so. And he says, I don't think I can come back because I made a commitment to 15 kids that I would help them get through school this year. And because of that commitment, I'm now in Green Bay. At the time that I said that, I didn't know if we could start a school or not, because I knew we didn't have the financial base. You have, when you talk about education, you have to talk turkey with money. And we didn't have money, but we had concern. We had commitment by individuals. So we opened a school. Fantastic building, but lots of bills. But for some reason, Creator must be looking down at us and saying, these people are working hard. because we're functioning on a very low subsistence level, but not in terms of quality education, not subsistence, but high quality because of our teachers. 16, 80 years old. Boy, you can't get anybody better than that. You know, most of the people booted them out, said they're too old to teach. And it was really amazing. We were at a press conference, and the television people were trying to set us up, asking us questions, trying to blow it, you know, in front of an audience, you know, a television audience, local television audience, about our school. And they were saying, well, you know, do you feel that you're inadequately staffed with these elder people in this school? And one of the students, he's 14 years old, he says, you know, buddy, he goes, that's your problem. He says, you put all these young bucks in as teachers. They don't know anything yet. He says, but man, he goes, this person here, that 80 years of experience, I can't think of anybody else better. He goes, you know, you should put that on television. He didn't know he was on the air at the time. He says, you should put that on television and tell more people about that. He says, then there wouldn't be so many people having problems in the public school system. I kind of smiled and said, yeah, that's one of my students, all right. Those type of things are what, to me, I feel I have to share with you. Because those, to me, are education and learning at its best. This person, 14 years old, he could make you stand up on end in terms of his education from the street. But his education in terms of survival on a system level, he doesn't have it yet. But he's willing to work at it. His brother, 17. He's gone to school, high school. He's supposed to be a senior this year. Well, he was a senior at a public school system. He had 2 credits. He was a senior. I don't know how they got it that way, but you know, I have to have 18 according to the state of Wisconsin to graduate. So he said, well, there's no way I'm going to graduate. He says, I can't wait till I'm 25. He said, but I'll go GED. He says, I'll work at it. I says, well, you know, you got a whole year to do it. He says, I'm going to have it done by February because there's a job that I want to get because we're having a job opening in the school and he wants that job to work in the school after he graduates GED. And I says, well, I says, Steve, you got a lot of work to do. He says, don't worry about it, man. He goes, I can do it. And I says, well, it's up to you. He says, but you got to come to school. He says, well, how about we work this? He goes, I'll be janitor in the morning for the school if you can get me some money, you know, to tide me over. I said, okay. So I went out a couple of churches, saw what I could do, got just a little bit of money and salaried him, you know, $1, quarter an hour, 2 hours in the morning. That was his way of getting to school early because I caught him one morning. 7:30 in the morning, he's got that GED book open. He's sitting on a blackboard like this doing mathematics. I was wondering how come the floors were dirty. He was conning me. He did it. It's not even February yet. He was done with his GED test by December. He only had 2 credits to graduate. So we're putting him on as a youth outreach worker for some of the other kids. He's 17 years old, but he's some kind of guy. Hard worker, and he listens to those teachers, 60-year-olds. You know, those are the people that are important. This is why we try and learn about this area over here. Because this, to us, is where these answers are found. Right over here. And I'm not criticizing public education, because it is a necessity. But it's set up in such a fashion that you can't go on a one-to-one basis with people because of the masses. It's a reality. And because of that, there's a need for alternative education. There's a need for some type of, you know, survival school, you'd like to call it that. You know, we've already been accused of guerrilla tactics by Mr. Durham, teaching communism, grenade launching, Molotov cocktails. That was a home ec course. So, you know, that's what survival is supposed to mean to some people. To them, survival is a word that it's a down and out word. You only use it when you're down and out, when you're surviving. You know, that's scratching. To us, survival is mean. It means to get along with one another. That old word, long time ago, in the, I think it's the 60s or 70s, you do your own thing, you know. That's fine. But an eagle doesn't do that. Every feather on an eagle can't do his own thing, because each one has a responsibility. None of them have the luxury of priorities. Each has a responsibility. We go along that philosophical concept also with the school. Maybe I could give you a brief rundown of what we have running out of our school right now. Classes start at 8:30 in the morning, run through until 2:30. At that time, we have a FIAD program that started up. Our curriculum consists of Oneida language, Oneida culture, Menominee language, Native American literature, mathematics, reading, urban survival. Urban survival is my gig. That's my course. Guerrilla warfare. No. In my course, urban survival, one of the first things we do, the first day you walk in there, you're in a simulation game. You're given $500. You set up your budget for a month. You rent your house. You pay your bills. You pay for food. And you have to have enough left over to buy your baby some clothes on the side for $500. That's just a little bit more than what you get on an unemployment check, which a lot of people in our area live off of from week to week. So we said, okay, that's the first thing you do. Is you see if you can survive on that. You set up your own budget. And so we ran that for a week. You know, they study it intensely. Go into stores, you know, budgeting out the food, find out which store, you know, kind of a consumerism course, where they go and find out how much this costs in this store, how much it costs in this store, and if I should go there, if I should go there. They go right down into the papers and look for houses, you know, cheap houses. One of them even went and actually put down a deposit on one. Then he came to me the next day and he asked me if I had the money for him. And I looked at him and I said, you didn't really, did you? And he said, yes, I did. And so ended up, we called it a townhouse now. We're still renting it. We've had it for 2 months now. And it's a good place to go. It's another drop-in center, I guess you could say, for some of the kids. Because of their family structure and things like that, that, you know, perhaps Pat Bellinger spoke about family structure for Indian people on a traditional perspective. I would like to talk about a little bit on a realistic perspective. And I hope I don't offend anybody. Alcoholism in our neighborhood runs rampant. Kids at 8 years old take care of themselves. You know, that's nothing new. You've read books about, you know, that type of survival. I don't have to tell you any more about that, I don't think. Some of our kids, hardcore people at the age of 9. I tell you, relate a story to you about that. I like to tell stories when I speak somewhere. We went to a summer camp this summer, part of our program. And this little girl, she's about 7 years old or so. And we went to this camp, and the counselors there were non-Indians, basically from, you know, the nice part of Wisconsin. And they came up, running up to this little girl, and how are you, and hugged her, and started kissing her, showing her affection. She's never had affection like that. So she just, in short, wound up and gave everyone the chops. And it was amusing at the time, but it was really, to me, it was really sickening. Because that girl, at 7, had no affection ever shown to her because of their family situation. You know, low income. Their need to survive didn't incorporate that at the time. So I guess, you know, the seed of a school has been in my mind for a long time. My need to survive dictates that I help other people.
as an individual. A person calls me up 3 o'clock in the morning, wants me to help him. It's kind of hard sometimes. Nice warm bed, 6 below outside. There, you know, the heat's turned off or something or other. The furnace has gone out, call you up, ask you to come over and help. That's tough. But it has to be done. Someone has to do it. If that ego is to soar. I'll keep referring to that tonight because each person has their responsibility. And if we don't do it, then we can start believing in that 1980 book, Population Bomb, things like that. They're realities also. You've heard many times over about the Black Mesa, the fuel situation, the oil embargo, the Middle East, things like this. Those also are realities of the school, because we have to cope with those also. We're very conscious of the world situation. We're also very very cautious of this year that's coming up, when all of you will be celebrating your 200th birthday. There's a lot of things that, you know, to me, have to be answered before we can light those candles. Maybe we'll have to wait till the 300th before we even can. In a form of protest, I guess you could say, that we also, that is one of the reasons why we opened the Soaring Eagle Survival School. That after 200 years of public and private education, there are still some people's needs that aren't being met. And experts say, well, you know, you don't get to everybody, and that's just, and maybe that's true. But I believe the other way. That if you can get to a couple and get them on the road, they're going to remember that, and they're going to help a couple more. And you get those on the road, and you got a couple more coming after that. And if you get someone on the road in a quality way, they can help a hell of a lot more people than just talking to the masses, is my feeling. And that's the Soaring Eagle Survival School. We have 46 students. We started out with 25. In 2 weeks, we had 46, and got a waiting list of 50 that we can't put in because we didn't have enough money. Because we believe our quality comes first before quantity. We could put all those people in there and just impress the hell out of everybody and say, look at all these kids in here. You know, but we wouldn't be giving them what we say we want to give them, in terms of our philosophy of education, in terms of our cultural philosophy in education, in terms of our academic philosophy. We believe that we have to have these quality things to get one person down the road. And we have two people now working back in a school that were students the first semester. The semester break is right now. We go back next Monday. And we have a spirit ceremony and a tobacco offering on the first day. Our drum, more or less cultural day, first day. Everybody be glad to get back. In the evenings, we run a GED prep program for parents that haven't graduated yet. We have a language program that we have started. We have an Indian center that we're kind of started that come out of our townhouse. We just got a pool table. I took away my couch that I used to sleep on and put a pool table in the living room so kids can come over and play pool. It's kind of hard. You know, sometimes I'm really tempted some night just put my sleeping bag on that table and curl up. It looks kind of comfortable. It's a lot warmer than the floor. But this is part of survival, you know. It's part, to me, it's part of making that eagle soar. You know, 200 years. I'd like to get in a little bit of bicentennial just for you folk that really dig this stuff. 200 years, where we're at right now. 200 years of resistance in terms of the Native American person. And we're not teaching guerrilla warfare again in terms of the bicentennial within the school, but rather we're trying to teach awareness. We're trying to teach the kids to be aware of this 200 years. You know, they're doing a study. They're doing a breakdown right now. One of the courses being offered in the second semester is called Declaration of Independence 76. That's the course number, 76. And in that course, they're breaking down the Declaration of Independence that was issued by some radicals, 1776. And they're taking that apart, piece by piece. There's words of savage in there. There's words of non-intelligible and all kinds of things. Really juicy thing when you look at it. And they're teaching, they're trying to teach one another how to survive with that, try to understand it a little bit better. They're trying to understand why people raise their head to that flag and put their hand over their heart. Because they want it, they want to know if they do it, there's a responsibility that goes along with it. And if they feel that they want to do that, then they have to know about it. This is their feeling. I'm just relating this to you. That if they are to sing the Star Spangled Banner and put their hand over their heart, they want to know where they fit in, where their place is. And so massive letter writing has gone out from our school to congressmen, inviting them over to explain a little bit about the Declaration of Independence, American history. You know, hopefully it'd be really nice if we were able to have William Proxmire teach a course in American history for one afternoon. You know, if Henry Kissinger could stop over, he might learn a lot about foreign policy between the Iroquois Confederacy and the American government. Those are just little things that come out every day. That these students that we have are very aware of the world situation now. Before, they didn't have time for it. They're too busy fighting, scratching. They can relax now in the educational environment. Their ego is starting to come together. Each one of them is taking a responsibility. Another story that comes to my mind about our school is when it was really cold out, our bus wasn't running. We had no money for put the gas in it, so the gas line froze. We could have ice skated on it so hard. And we're wondering how the students from Lake Oneida, which is about 20 miles from the school, out in the res, were going to come into town. We couldn't figure out how they're going to get there. So we called them up and told them, you know, just got a day off. You're lucky because we can't come out and get you. We don't have any way out there. All of a sudden, this is our townhouse, knocking the door, 4:30 in the morning. Whole 8 kids knocking on their door. Let us in, it's cold outside. What the devil are you doing here? Well, we found someone that was coming in town to go to work for 5 o'clock. So we figured we'll catch a ride in with them if we can leave early at 1:30, because that's when they go back out to the res. And I had goosebumps all over me. I don't know if it was because it was cold or because it really moved me. I'll let you decide. I sure as hell wouldn't have done that. Or that St. Olaf. But their need to learn, their need to make that ego go, move them to that point. Now, these are just isolated situations. And they'll defend that because they believe in that school. Because a lot of them, this is the last stop before they go to an institution of some sort. Some of them, with my job in the public school system, have said, principal said to me, pulled me on his side and said, hey, I just don't know what to do with this guy. He's too much trouble. What can you do with him? I kind of laugh at him. You know, what have you been doing with him? One of my questions. Why is he the way he is that you don't know what to do with him? Is he that big of a discipline problem? Or is it just because of, you know, just don't have enough time to understand him? So, another candidate for the Soaring Eagle Survival School. We've been titled the School of Misfits, the School of Has-Beens, School of Outlaws. Doug Durham came to Green Bay. Well, just his tape recorder did. He didn't make it. He was scared of the truth. We had built a fundraiser for our school, Soaring Eagle Survival School's first annual celebration, November 21st. I invited some of you people here to that. Unfortunately, you weren't able to make it. But it was probably the biggest event in terms of some of these kids, because they planned the powwow. They did everything. We just stood around with our hands in our pockets and watched it happen. We did more, I guess you could say we did the politicking. All of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, a group of people called the John Birch Society decided that it was time to see what the survival school is about. Doug Durham was speaking on November 21st, the same night. Now, we don't, if he wants to speak, fine. But what we felt is that it's really hard for these kids to understand that that individual, Doug Durham, was coming to town. And they heard and read a lot of things, because we use a lot of John Birch Society material as part of our curriculum within the school. Because we use Superman comic books, too. Because they teach a lot about stereotypes and the Aryan race, supremacy, things like this. He's kind of, you know, I was sitting around one day with a Superman comic book. I said, man, this is kind of cool. I like to read them anyway, so I figured why not teach something about them. So, getting back to Durham, though. To us, he represented segregation. He represented hatred. He represented everything that we're trying to work against. We're trying to work towards bicognitive awareness, understanding. And because of this understanding, we felt that he's doing us wrong. So we asked our traditional people, we said, what should we do? They said, well, we'll have a spirit ceremony. We tied 7 knots of tobacco together for the 7 fires. And we spoke to some people about it. And then that afternoon, we had a press conference, and we told how we felt about it. We proclaimed our powwow as a protest against Durham. We asked all the people to boycott him, which was done. He didn't show up in town. This is tape recorder did. The tape recorder spoke to about 100 people that evening. 40 of them were people that we knew that we infiltrated in there to find out what he was saying about it. The other 60 were, well, 30 of them, the other 30 were undercover police agents from the city. The other 25 were FBI agents. And 5 of them were John Birch Society people. But he was speaking of the truth of America, as he stated. Fine. Perhaps. I'll leave it up to you. I don't hold any grudges against anybody. But we just didn't have time. We don't have time for hatred. We don't have time for segregation. We didn't have time for these type of things. Because we have enough people trying to find out themselves individually to become sensitive enough to be aware of other people. So we didn't have time to deal with them the way we'd like to. Because our priority, the only priority that we have, are 46 students. And hopefully more later on. Because to us, they're important. Education is important to me. That's why I went to school. I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to be a brain surgeon until I took anatomy in school here. And I said, well, I'll be something else then. Now I was going to be a lawyer. But that's a conflict of my values also. So I decided, well, education is, I enjoy that. So I decided, it's really something where you can do something for another person. And I stayed here 2 years. I want to finish. I really do. I feel I have to as an individual to make that eagle strong. But in closing, there's a Lakota circle that you've heard much about. That's balance that you have to have. We believe that that's important in society, in people, in individuals, if we're to have that sensitivity and awareness. That you balance out your family to your religion. You balance out your friends, you know, to what you do academically, your knowledge. Everything has to be on a balance. Iroquois people have a story, in the creation story, there's a story about the left-hand brother and the right-hand brother. Once again, creating balance. We felt that that was important at that time, long time ago. That was during this period here, before 1492. That reminds me of another story, speaking about this. A high official in Washington was talking at a meeting. Vine Deloria was there. And he turned to Vine Deloria, and he said, "What did the Indians do for Christmas before Columbus came?" This person was an individual who was speaking for Indian people on the hill. He was a legislator who was working for the good of Indian people. And he didn't know about that or Thanksgiving either. He wasn't sensitive to himself. He didn't have enough responsibility within himself to learn of what he was speaking about. So therefore, one could hypothesize that he didn't have enough awareness of other things going around him. And he was representing you people, and myself also. I'm kind of concerned about that. I wonder how many more there are like that. That circle is as important and has the same symbolism and strength as the eagle. For the circle has the strength. Everything is equal on that circle. On a circle, there's equality. I find it hard to speak of circles in an environment like this, where I'm standing in front of one of these things, and each row up, there's people looking down at me. And I always remember that one movie about science fiction. You know, each one of these people are brain surgeons, and each one of you had power. And the teacher down here was teaching everybody how to make the world go, so everyone would not do that. But, I don't know, the theory still was canceled. I never heard the end of it. I'd just like to say one more thing. That I believe, and very optimistic for people, as long as you keep that idealism, or that ideology of an eagle, where everyone has a responsibility. With every freedom, there's a responsibility. Within a circle, each one has a responsibility also, within himself, of balancing that out. Be concerned. Be sensitive enough to yourself to understand and seek knowledge about one another so that you can be aware of others. Then hopefully someday, myself or Paul, or, you know, other people can come back, can talk about brotherhood and awareness and say, by gosh, you know, survival schools aren't that bad. They're not that threatening. Home ec class does not consist of Molotov cocktails. Indian culture class does not consist of breechcloth design and bone and arrows. That things like this can be, you know, brought about. That hopefully someday in American history class, you hear about the fact that General Custer was the first person to wear an arrow shirt tailored by Crazy Horse. That he wasn't all that bad either. That these things are important. You have a responsibility to yourself. You were going to college. I was too. But you have a responsibility to be sensitive enough and aware of others and what they're doing and respect them enough to listen and weigh it. And hopefully, I invite you all to come down to our school. If you know how to be sensitive, if you know how to be aware, we need help, but we only need people that are sensitive to themselves and know a little bit about sharing. Thank you for letting me come, and if there's any questions now, We'll talk about those for a while.
That was Artley Skenendor, Jr., speaking on Native American survival schools, a talk recorded January 15th, the fifth in a series of lectures at St. Olaf College on Native American values and the dominant American culture. Once again, we apologize for the audio quality of tonight's program. It will improve with next week's broadcast, which is a lecture by Henry Fritz, professor of history at St. Olaf College, given as the sixth program in this series. The title of his talk, Federal Policy Toward Native Americans Before Wounded Knee. This series of lectures is made possible in part by a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This grant also provides partial funding for this series of broadcasts. We invite you to join us next Sunday evening at 7 o'clock for Discourse.